Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the growing wealth gap. It's a theme that increasingly defines a number of American cities, including the Boston area.
The racial differences and ethnic differences are immense, especially in the Boston metro area.
Also today, as Boston police move cautiously into the world of police body cameras, we ride with the officers of Methuen, who already have them.
So right now it's still rolling. Every 2 minutes while it's recording, it beeps to let you know it's still beeping. But right now we can go ahead and turn it off, and well, it's off.
Plus, violinist Jason Anik and his Gypsy Jazz.
It's a music that is so deserving to be heard in its very high level. So we're not trying to change the style. We're just trying to bring some youthful energy and some fresh ideas.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with a look at growing income and wealth disparity in Boston. It's a major theme of the presidential campaign, and it's part of the focus this week of a national conversation called A Nation Engaged, which WBUR is participating in with other NPR member stations, exploring the challenge of creating economic opportunity for more Americans. So when it comes to the wealth gap here in Greater Boston, it is amplified in a big way by race. So let's explore that a bit. Last June, we asked this question about Boston. How is it that a city with one of the country's most robust economies is also the American city with the highest rate of income inequality? In that story, we met Janine Skinner, who'd made a successful transition from welfare to work. But she told us about her struggles and about one of the major goals for her family, a kitchen table.
People don't realize, people in my situation, we don't have. You know, I come to work with people that probably make, you know, great money and have beautiful homes. And I go home where we sit on the floor. So this is something that I think is a very, sorry, I'm getting emotional.
Yeah.
You know, so have a place for me and my family to sit and eat dinner together every night.
After hearing that story, WBUR listeners reached out to Janine Skinner and bought her a kitchen table, even helped her pay some of her bills. Things have improved in other ways for Skinner and her husband. Now they both have stable jobs with a nonprofit in Boston. And Skinner hopes to start her own nonprofit, which she wants to call The Kitchen Table, to help others transition from welfare to work. But she says she and her husband are still a long way from a key piece of the American dream.
Currently, we're looking to buy a home, and it is quite a struggle across the board.
A struggle because Boston has some of the highest housing prices in the country. And because when times were tough, Skinner and her husband relied on credit cards to pay their bills and fell behind. Skinner also has more than $30,000 in student loans, so their credit score is too low to qualify for a mortgage.
We are both weren't educated on the importance of having a higher credit score. So we are diligently working on, you know, paying off past due balances. So it has been very difficult.
Skinner, who is African American, and her husband, who's the son of Haitian immigrants, are still struggling to make it in a city with a dramatic racial disparity in wealth. So says Patricia Munoz, an assistant vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and the author of a recent report, The Color of Wealth in Boston.
And when you get deeper into the data, you really realize that the racial differences and ethnic differences are immense, especially in the Boston metro area.
Munoz found a widening wealth gap along racial lines. Among the key findings, white households have a median net worth, that's the value of their assets minus their debts, of about $250,000. The median net worth of black households, almost zero. The report also found that black households, like Janine Skinner's, have much more debt than white households. And almost 80% of white families own a home, while just a third of black families do. Munoz says that means blacks have much less ability than whites to pass wealth on to their children, perpetuating the racial wealth gap.
It's really the money that's passed down from generation to generation. So whites are more likely to get help to buy a house or more likely to get help to pay for education. And so then you see the cumulative consequences reflected in that number.
By contrast, consider the experience of Seti Warren, who inherited his home in the wealthy town of Newton.
I think about my story and how fortunate I've been, because there's no way my wife and I would be able to afford to live in that house right now if not for the intergenerational transfer of our home.
Warren is not just a fortunate homeowner in Newton. He's the mayor, and he's African American. And he's keenly aware of the racial wealth gap and how few blacks are in his position. Warren's father was a Korean War vet who bought the family home with the help of the GI Bill.
This idea that if you work hard, you're able to take care of yourself and you're able to ensure that your child's life will be better off than yours. That story is something that we're losing.
Home ownership is the major way families pass on and build wealth. But in Massachusetts, if you're not white, chances are your family doesn't own a home. Statewide, almost 70% of white families own their own homes, but less than a third of black, Latino, and Asian families do. Here's Tom Callahan, executive director of the Massachusetts Affordable Housing Alliance.
That is the second widest gap in the nation. That surprises some people because we feel like we're a progressive state with progressive policies around housing. And we are in a lot of ways, but the homeownership gap has been stubbornly large and actually in recent years has even widened slightly.
To address that gap, Callahan favors federal, state, and local policies to build more middle and low-income housing units, among other policies. He says that would help close the housing gap and that yawning wealth gap, which the Boston Fed calls a public policy challenge requiring immediate attention. Well, joining us now to talk more about the home ownership gap and how it contributes to the wealth gap in Boston is Barry Bluestone. He's professor of political economy at Northeastern University and the founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. And Barry, it's always great to have you. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be back, Anthony.
So, first of all, talk a little bit about how closely linked this home ownership gap is with this dramatic wealth gap that we were just hearing about.
Well, it actually runs both ways. Because there's such a big income gap between whites and others in our community, the chances of home ownership, of course, are going to be much lower for people with lower income, and that's disproportionately people of color. Mm. However, it runs the other way. That is, the major form of wealth that people hold in this country, with the exception of the very, very wealthy, is their homes. In my generation, and I'm going to be 72 this year, you bought your home when you were young, you watched it appreciate in value, and that was part of your retirement asset that you used. So the problem is that the income gap leads to differential homeownership gap, and the differential homeownership gap then leads to even greater wealth inequality from generation to generation. Mm.
And I imagine as well that when we talk about a wealth gap and a home ownership gap along racial lines, that some of the policies of the past have had an effect as well. That is, we lived through a period in this country where there were discriminatory policies around housing, around mortgage lending. There has to be a legacy to that as well, right?
Absolutely. I grew up in the city of Detroit in the boom days, but a highly segregated Detroit. And what happened in the 1950s and 60s is that white families were able to move to the suburbs. And they bought homes, some of them on the GI Bill, and then they watched them appreciate dramatically. Black families had trouble moving to the suburbs, and often because of racial covenants or just because of antagonism. So they stayed in the city, and if they could afford to buy a home, they did. But prices in the city have fallen for homes. And so while the value of the assets went up in the suburbs for whites, the value of the home assets for blacks in the city fell. Hmm. It also meant that there'd be differentials in the ability to fund schools, and this led to all kinds of problems. So again, initial differences in segregation, initial differences in income lead to this tremendous difference in home ownership and assets. Hmm.
We heard from Tom Callahan in the report we just heard, the executive director of the Massachusetts Affordable Housing Alliance, and says one of the big keys in closing this gap in home ownership is to build more middle income and affordable housing units. Is that a good place to start? Is he right?
He's absolutely right, but unfortunately, trying to build housing for working families and middle-income housing particularly in the greater Boston area, is virtually impossible.
Why is that?
The cost of building has just gone through the roof. The cost of land, the soft costs of meeting regulations, construction costs. Last year's Greater Boston Housing Report Card that we released with the Boston Foundation showed that the average cost per square foot of building housing is now $276 a square foot. That means if you built a triple-decker, let's take the one that Ted Williams lived in when he returned from World War II in Alston, Brighton. That simple triple-decker with three units of 1,200 square feet each would cost over $1 million today. Mm. So what we're seeing is that developers, of course, have been building luxury housing, and we've probably may even have a surplus of that now. Some of them can build highly subsidized housing for the very poor. But we have no way of building housing for working families and middle-income families. And so, one, they can't get into the homeownership market. Two, it forces rents through the roof. And three, we're now seeing more and more of those families having to move further and further away from the city, central city of Boston into the suburbs. And not surprisingly, that's leading to tremendous transportation problems and congestion.
Right.
So one problem leads to another, leads to another.
So what's the solution? I mean, I know these are problems that have, as we've been suggesting, have been sort of compounded generation over generation. But where do we need to go? And if we don't address this, where does this take us?
Well, one thing that I've been talking with a lot of people about is trying to find a way to do what I call housing jujitsu. And what I meant by that is, if we can't build housing for working families, perhaps there's housing that's appropriate for them. Think about the 40% of all our units that are triple-deckers. But most of those, or many of those units, have been taken over by millennials, by my graduate students at Northeastern, by interns and residents at MGH. I'd like to see us build housing that would be more appropriate for them. Call them millennial villages or startup villages mm-hmm. that Mass Challenge would want to do, or an artist village that Boston Conservatory is talking about. If we could build that kind of housing, we could open up some of the older housing. We could renovate it. And it would go back to the working families that housing was originally built for when we had the large immigrant flows at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. Mm-hmm. So given the high cost of housing construction, and I don't see that coming down, we have to try some other kind of trick to make that work. And then we also have to make sure that we have the credit available for families to get into the housing market, not so they go, you know, underwater, but so that they can take advantage of that housing stock that would come on the market once again. This would also lower the prices of those units, which have gone up 85% in the last 6 years, so making them somewhat more affordable.
You know, Tom Callahan said something to me that I found intriguing, that many people might be surprised that in a state like Massachusetts, with its progressive traditions, there's such a wide racial gap when it comes to home ownership. Is he right about that? In other words, as stark as that division is here, are we doing better than other parts of the country, or what's your perspective on that?
I haven't studied the country, and I don't know how this compares with, let's say, some southern cities where there's still more racism than we have here in some cases. But I think the problem is it's a legacy that goes back and it gets built up decade over decade, and it's going to take, unfortunately, more decades to unravel. The legacy of racism goes back a long time, and while we've made great progress, no doubt about that, there's still a lot to be done, and it shows up more clearly in the wealth distribution that you talked about and in the Fed study than any place else.
Hmm. I want to ask you about the federal role, because a part of this series that we're doing, A Nation Engaged, is sort of inspired by the fact that this is an election year and we're asking, what can be done to increase the wealth of all Americans. Do the feds have a role here? I mean, once upon a time, we thought about the feds having a role in public housing, but the sense that I get is not so much anymore.
Well, the feds have always played a major role, particularly after World War II with the GI Bill, which was really what put most people in their homes, or many people in their homes. And of course, they also underwrite most mortgages through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two large mortgage underwriters. I don't know how much more the feds can actually do to encourage it. At the low end, they encourage it through housing vouchers and through tax subsidies for builders to build affordable housing. The real question is whether they could extend that up a bit in order to be able to also provide some subsidies for builders to build middle-income housing. Right now, I don't see much, you know, appetite for that, but perhaps we'll see that in the future.
All right. Well, that's Barry Bluestone, professor of political economy at Northeastern University and the founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. Barry, always a pleasure. Thank you very much. And listeners, you can find a link to that study on the wealth gap from the Boston Federal Reserve at radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome to Radio, but back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Charlotte, North Carolina is the latest American city to deal with a fatal police shooting of an African-American man. There have been scores of these tragedies from Ferguson to Tulsa and now Charlotte. They're fueling the push for police body cameras, which advocates say protect members of the community and police who often face difficult split-second life or death decisions. Here in Boston, 100 police officers are now equipped with body cameras as part of a six-month pilot program. The Boston Police Patrolmen's Association resisted it, but after a judge sided with the city, the plan is going forward. Other police departments in Massachusetts are moving ahead with police body cams, including Methuen, which this summer became the first major force in the state to put body cams on all of its uniformed patrol officers. Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna took a ride with one Methuen police officer to see how the program is working.
Right now, this is going to be Merrimack Street towards the Haverhill Line. I'm just going to go to the end of the boundary, go down the Haverhill Line, and then start going back up, checking, you know, the businesses, traffic enforcement, answering calls for service.
25-year-old police officer Matthew Morrell is out on a routine patrol in Methuen. Morrell has been a cop in Methuen for the last 2 years. When he's on patrol, his equipment includes radar, a radio, computer, Kevlar vest, a firearm, and a taser. And as of this past summer, that equipment also includes a body camera about the size of a deck of cards attached to his chest.
So right now it's still rolling. Every 2 minutes while it's recording, it beeps to let you know it's still beeping. Flashes red. Right now we can go ahead and turn it off and hold it down and it's off.
Control to P-150.
Standing by.
Can you check on two motor vehicles that appear abandoned on the property?
This is Officer Morrell's first call of his shift, to investigate two possibly abandoned cars at a home. Before Morrell gets out of his cruiser, he hits record on the body camera.
Just double tap that. Now it's recording audio and video, so.
Morrell heads toward the house to talk to the resident about the cars. His camera beeps every 2 minutes to remind anyone in front of it that he's recording. Turns out that nothing was amiss with those cars, but Morrell still has to log and record every interaction, including this one. Back in the cruiser, he uploads the video to an iPod, reviews it, and gives it a name.
You know, you can fast forward through it. Talking to her.
2 minutes while it's recording, it beeps, so you know it's still beeping.
Two cars on property would be a good title.
Uh-huh. Methuen's police camera program is overseen by Sergeant Thomas McMenamin, Jr. When he was president of the Methuen Police Union, McMenamin helped write the guidelines for the department and tried to address the concerns of some officers.
You know, the biggest concern with the union was we didn't want the department or the administration to constantly sit there and review body camera footage to try to nitpick what the officer was doing or how he was, you know, dressing. Or if he, you know, if he did something like a minor infraction, we don't want to constantly, we don't want Big Brother out there watching over the shoulder.
The guidelines respond to that concern by restricting supervisors from using footage for the sole purpose of searching for violations and getting an officer in trouble. Methuen's police chief, Joseph Solomon, is a big proponent of the program. He says after the police-involved shooting in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, he decided that he wanted his department to lead the way in Massachusetts on body cameras.
So I thought what a great way to say, here's a bird's eye view, unfiltered, you know, no opinions. Here's the body camera video as soon as we can legally release it and let the public decide.
Chief Solomon says body cameras help diffuse the kind of racial tensions around policing a city like Methuen, which is 80% white. And he says body cams are part of an evolving approach to law enforcement.
When I became a cop, it was arrest everybody and we'll figure it out later on. Today, it's what can we do to prevent having to arrest you and coming back 15 times? Can we resolve a neighborhood issue? Or can we get you public service somewhere? And then maybe we don't have to have that negative interaction. And that's a big change in our profession from 30 years ago.
Methuen might hold some lessons for Boston as it moves cautiously into the world of body cameras. While some in Boston resist the idea, Chief Solomon urges them to be open-minded.
P-141 control.
P-141.
Clear Lawrence General returning.
Copy.
Back in his cruiser, Methuen officer Matthew Morrell agrees.
A lot of people are just afraid of change, especially if you have someone that's been doing the job, you know, 30 years. And, you know, back in the day, there used to be call boxes. You got your calls from call boxes. And one day, the radio came out, and you were always available, and people didn't like that. You know, society's, you know, pushing the demanding they want the transparency, and there's nothing really to worry about. There's nothing to hide. Just do the job right.
All of the Methuen officers I spoke with said something similar. There was some initial resistance from some cops, but once they started using the cameras, even the skeptics got on board. The Methuen Police Department has about 100 officers and enough cameras for the 47 who patrol the streets. The department hopes to get funding for some 20 more cameras to cover detectives and plainclothes officers.
P-150.
Permission to return for a moment.
Affirmative.
Copy. Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna riding along there with Methuen Police Officer Matthew Morrell. Stay with us. Coming up, Gypsy Jazz from the Rhythm Future Quartet live in our studio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In December of 1903, on a windswept ocean dune in North Carolina, two bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio, changed history. With his brother Wilbur watching nervously, Orville Wright successfully took off in a heavier-than-air-powered aircraft. He flew for 120 feet for just 12 seconds. That short jump in the air launched the era of human flight, when many people didn't believe that human flight was even possible.
Oh, the popular opinion was that anybody that took seriously the aspiration to fly was crazy. And many of them were.
This is David McCullough, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian. His book, The Wright Brothers, which tells this extraordinary story, is out in paperback now. So we thought we'd revisit our interview with him from last summer. McCullough says despite the popular idea that human flight was virtually impossible, there were a number of serious scientists working hard to disprove that. People like Samuel Pierpont Langley, a Harvard astronomer and physicist. But the Wright brothers were different. They were untrained, self-taught. They hadn't even finished high school. But David McCullough says not only did they figure out the theory of flight, they also became real pilots.
And that is one of the basic differences between many of the theorists and the Wright brothers. It isn't just that they invented the first plane, the first flying machine, to carry a motor-driven machine that would carry a pilot, but they learned to fly it. And that is of the absolute utmost importance to understand.
Because it wasn't just theoretical for them.
That's right. Yeah. Wilbur had a wonderful analogy. He said there two ways to train an unbroken horse. One is to sit on the fence and keep notes and then retire to a comfortable chair and write a learned paper on how to tame an unbroken horse. The other is to get on the horse and ride it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did. And did so at huge risk to themselves. Anytime either one went up, he knew that there was a good chance he could be killed.
Right. At first blush, they seem almost like the most unlikely candidates to figure this out. I mean, they came from a humble background. They never attended college. And yet they end up solving one of the world's great technological riddles.
And they did it all themselves.
All by themselves.
It isn't just that they financed it themselves.
Yeah.
With their earnings from their bicycle shop, but that they figured it out themselves. And when they discovered that the data used, technical data used by people like Langley, was wrong. It was, as Orville said, worthless. Then they had to start all over again and become physicists. Nothing seemed to discourage them to the point where they gave up. Nothing. They grew up in a house that had no running water, no indoor plumbing, no electricity, no telephone, but was full of books. And their father, an itinerant minister, encouraged them, pressed them to read. They never even finished high school. It's humbling.
David McCullough, I want to ask you about the central challenge that they took on, which is so interesting. And it wasn't so much getting a flying machine off the ground and into the air as it was figuring out how to have a stable flight, a balanced flight, and really control the flight. So what was the breakthrough that the Wright brothers figured out?
Well, the first breakthrough was that they realized they had to study birds. They had to study soaring birds. In other words, birds that can get up there and just hang on the wind, not flap their wings at all. And they did that, and the local people at Kittyhawk thought they were really loony, because they're out there waving their arms up and down, twisting their hands and their wrists. And Orville said that learning how to fly by watching a soaring bird was like learning how to do magic from a magician. Hmm. And they developed, the brothers, what they called wing warping, which was a way of twisting the wings so that they could bank and turn, fly in circles, fly in figure eights. The very first plane to fly in 1903 at Kitty Hawk couldn't do that. It could take off, stay in the air, and land. And it wasn't for another 2 years that they developed what was really the first practical airplane.
But let me ask you, though, about that very first flight, December 17th, 1903, on the wind-swept dunes of Kitty Hawk. Orville Wright, he flew 120 feet. He was airborne for just 12 seconds. And you say they barely flew a mile, but they had done it.
Yes, they knew they had it. They knew they'd done it.
But how did that very short distance represent such a huge success? Why?
Because it took off, stayed in the air, and landed at the same elevation. In other words, it wasn't going downhill like a glider does.
Yeah.
It went straight. And the motor they put on the glider was in itself a huge innovation. It was made out of aluminum. Nobody had ever made a motor out of aluminum before. So it was lightweight, but yet it had sufficient power.
But you write that those first historic flights were virtually unnoticed by the public.
They didn't care. They didn't believe it. The Dayton papers wouldn't even send a reporter out to watch.
It's incredible.
Our federal government wouldn't send somebody out to take a look. The brothers volunteered to bring the plane to Washington and to demonstrate there.
And was this because people just couldn't believe it?
That too, but I think in part, and I really don't think there's been much doubt about it, because the Langley planes had been such a disastrous failure and so much money had been spent on them, that the War Department was not about to get into that business again for a while.
I see.
They were very skeptical about it.
And it would be almost 5 years later in France when the public would finally take notice. You write that Wilbur demonstrated his flying machine before thousands of people and eventually demonstrated to hundreds of thousands of people. Describe that reception in Europe for what they were doing.
Well, the first demonstration was given on the eighth day of the eighth month in the year 1908 at Le Mans, the great racetrack town. And the French were very enthusiastic about aviation. There were many French aviators by then. They had not perfected anything like the Wright brothers' plane. And when they saw Wilbur fly, they said, well, they are way ahead of us, meaning the brothers. We are but children, one of them said, compared to them. So the enthusiasm, the popularity among the French was far ahead of us here in America. But these two brothers were far ahead of anything in France. The French aviators, without exception, were all very rich men for whom this was kind of a life-risking sport. You'd go out to watch the air demonstrations the way you'd go to the racetrack to see the horse race or something. It was fashionable. Mm. And once the greatest of racehorses ever known to the world, Wilbur Wright, arrived in France, they all had to come and see the wonder, had to come see the miracle. And he didn't speak French, and he was very modest, and he was very American, and they loved him for it.
Huh.
And the more American he was, the more they loved him. He was the most popular American ever to come to France since Benjamin Franklin.
That's amazing.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was thrilling.
Meanwhile...
And justly so.
Yeah.
Justly so.
Of course. Meanwhile, back in America, Orville was demonstrating the same thing, but he suffers a huge setback, an almost fatal accident, right? Tell us what happened.
Well, he was at Fort Myer Airport across the Potomac from Washington, and he took a young lieutenant up with him named Selfridge, and there was a mechanical failure, and the plane went into a nosedive, went straight down 75 feet. And Selfridge, unfortunately, was killed. First fatality in the history of aviation. And Orville was very nearly killed. Many broken bones, leg broken in two places. But also damaged psychologically, badly damaged. And his sister, Catherine, she was teaching school in Dayton. And she phoned their principal, said she was taking an indefinite leave of absence, packed her bag and was on the train that evening. She came to the hospital where he was being treated at the Army base, and she stayed in the hospital for a month and about a week or 10 days, seeing him through this, physically and psychologically. In many ways, she saved his life. Many people thought he might never walk again, and the idea that he'd not only walk again, but he'd fly again, and fly right there at the same spot where he was nearly killed, and break several world's records is to me one of the most marvelous comeback stories I've ever had experience telling.
It's a great comeback story. I'm glad you mentioned Catherine because in your book, she's such a key character. You portray her as really one of the keys to the success of Wilburn and Orville Wright.
She was.
Yeah, tell us more about Catherine.
Well, she was the only one who went to college. She went to Oberlin, which was the first coeducational college in our country, and she was very bright, but very good grades. She was a tiny little woman, about 5 feet one at most. She had her hair pulled back in a bun and wore a gold-rimmed pince-nez glasses. She was the essence of the schoolmarm. But she was also very funny. She was very opinionated, and she could get mad. Wrathy, as she said. And she kept those brothers in line. And she also was there whenever they needed her.
There's so much to admire about these guys, and what you taught me and what I admire about them even more is that they become hugely famous. I mean, they become celebrities, but you write that their celebrity never really changed them.
Didn't change them in the slightest. It gave them a lot more money, but they didn't care about that particularly. They were in it because they felt it was inevitable and that they could do it. They could solve the problem. And the fact that someone like Leonardo da Vinci hadn't been able to solve it didn't bother them at all. And they knew all about that. Yeah. They read everything there was about aviation. Wilbur wrote a famous letter to the Smithsonian saying, "Send me everything you have." I see this, my book, as number three in a trilogy. The first was my book about the Brooklyn Bridge, the second about the Panama Canal. All three of those were immensely important, momentous achievements, achieved at tremendous risk of life. Many people died building the Brooklyn Bridge. Many people died at Panama working on the canal. And certainly the Wright brothers were risking their lives all the time. But that history can be changed and human aspirations can be inspired, encouraged by achievements other than in politics. History isn't just politics and war. It has to do with the creative energy that we bring to art, science, medicine, music, poetry. And in many ways, those achievements count for more longer.
Mm, I agree with that, yeah.
Yes, it is true. And we should teach history that way.
Mm-hmm.
We should think of history that way. And somebody like the Wright brothers are an essential element in our story. They are vitally important, and it's a huge tribute to the human spirit, human mind. We should take inspiration from such an example, not feel, oh, well, we don't produce people like that anymore. Sure we can. Mm-hmm. Of course we can.
You know what I just love thinking about in reading your book is how recent It is. And when we think of what airplanes are doing today, it's just incredible.
It is incredible. I could have known Orville Wright.
Yeah.
He died in 1948. I was 15 years old. He might have been that nice old gentleman around the corner that was such fun to speak to.
Yeah.
And yet, we get in a plane today. We go up to 30, 35, 40,000 feet, think nothing of it. I just read the other day that Chicago's O'Hare Airfield, 70 million people flew in and out of there in 1 year, 2014, last year. 70 million. I was flying somewhere recently at 35,000, and I'm editing one of the chapters of my book on the Wright brothers, and I thought, wait a minute. Here I am sailing along with 300 other people, or however many were in that airplane, and we just take it for granted.
Yeah.
Orville lived to see rockets and jet propulsion, and of course he also lived to see the horrors brought to the world in World War I and II by the airplane as a weapon. Like you, I have been interested in aviation my whole life. I built model airplanes when I was a boy with paper, and it has been on my mind for a good long while. And yet, I didn't know anything about the immense reach of the minds of these two men from Dayton, Ohio. And you go into their bicycle shop, which is at the Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan, and their house where they grew up. It's humbling to think how this all came to be. They are pioneers every bit as much as those who went west and covered wagons.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough talking with us last summer about his book, The Wright Brothers. It's now out in paperback. You can find more information about it at radioboston.org. This is music from the Boston-based Rhythm Future Quartet off their most recent album, Travels. Future Quartet was founded by jazz violinist Jason Anik, who calls this music gypsy jazz. Anik is one of the youngest instructors at the Berklee College of Music here in Boston, and he's shared the stage with a number of great artists, including Stevie Wonder. He'll be performing with his Rhythm Future Quartet Columbus Day weekend at the Django by the Sea Gypsy Jazz Festival in Kittery, Maine, and he's with us now along with his band. And Jason Anik, good to have you.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
And listeners, we're streaming this interview, and we'll be streaming the in-studio performance as well on Facebook Live, and you can watch it if you go to facebook.com/Radio Boston. You can see the performance and see the interview. So, Jason, we talked to you a couple of years ago. It's great to have you back. Tell me about this song, first of all, that we're listening to in the background off your new album.
Yes, that's For Paulus, which is one composed by Olli Soikkeli, who's kind of the co-leader of the group. He's unfortunately had some engagements in New York today, so today is just the trio, our normal, so it's 3/4 of the group, but that's one that, really captures the spirit of the forefathers of gypsy jazz, who were Django Reinhardt, a virtuoso guitarist who grew up in the gypsy culture, and French jazz violinist Stefan Grappelli. Oh. So it really pays tribute to those and kind of brings a new energy to it.
Will you define what gypsy jazz is? Is it defined by Django Reinhardt and Grappelli?
Yeah, so it's, you can think of it as kind of a mashup of the early swing. So early swing with some of the traditional gypsy music that was going on. So Django Reinhardt, who grew up in the gypsy culture, and was immersed in the more traditional music, but fell in love with the old swing. So when he heard Louis Armstrong for the first time, he wanted to emulate that. So he brought it to the instruments that were associated with their heritage. So he had guitar, and of course violin is a big instrument in that as well. So unlike other styles of jazz, gypsy jazz, the instrumentation is a little more unique. So it's has a rhythm guitar that is kind of sounding more like the drum. Mm-hmm. So that's emulating the snare drum and the drum kit. And then you have the bass, which you know, that kind of is similar. And then violin and guitar as the leaders.
All right. So we've got three quarters of the group here. This is Jason Anik, who's the violinist. Max O'Rourke is the guitar with the Rhythm Future Quartet. And Greg Loafman is going to play upright bass. And what are you going to do for us now?
So, you know, we're always trying to bring new songs into our repertoire, expand the genre. We love paying tribute to it, of course, but we're in the spirit of kind of expanding it and broadening the scope. We bring in songs from different generations. So this was a pop song of its day. This was Come Together, you know, the iconic Beatles tune. And so this is our arrangement of it.
All right, here we go. Come Together from the Rhythm Future Quartet with Jason Anik on violin, Max O'Rourke on rhythm guitar, and Greg Loafman on upright bass. Loafman on upright bass, sorry. Thank you. All right, very nice. That was three quarters of the Future Rhythm Quartet playing their version of the great Beatles song, Come Together. It's off their most recent album, Travels. And that was Jason Anik on violin, Max O'Rourke on guitar, and Greg Loafman on upright bass. Gentlemen, great work. That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Nice job, Jason. Love to hear something about how what goes into arranging a song like that, which, of course, is sort of part of every pop music devotee's consciousness. How did you go about thinking about arranging that?
Yeah, so that song in particular or just in general?
Yeah.
So I grew up listening to the Beatles a lot. So my dad was a big Beatles fan. So I grew up listening to it. And to me, the Beatles, you know, it's such a great forum for playing within a jazz setting as well. So I always like, there's a couple other Beatles songs that I've arranged over the years, so it's always in the back of my mind to like try to throw in a couple Beatles ones. And you know, I sometimes like I'll just hear it and I can kind of hear what it's like. I'll hear this original and this could work in the setting, and then we'll kind of play it together a bit and try to hash out how to bring it to this instrumentation, work out different parts, and then this course form, you know, you want to think about form, so where the solo section is going to be and how to, you know, make it your own. So the key was to have the melody within there, but within that framework, switch it up and bring new life to it.
Yeah, well, you did it really well. I want to say that the Rhythm Future Quartet is going to be performing Columbus Day weekend at the Django by the Sea Gypsy Jazz Festival in Kittery, Maine. And Jason Anik, you teach kids at Berkeley. Do they come in knowing about Gypsy Jazz? Is this what you teach them? Or sort of how does Gypsy Jazz fit into what you teach?
Certainly. So there are definitely some students that come in who were exposed to the music or were had fans of mine had heard me play or saw me perform, and they come specifically to study with me. And then some people, they're hearing it for the first time. But either way, I love to expose this music because I think it's a great style of music to play, specifically if you're a violinist. Yeah. You can really explore the colors and textures of the instrument as well as the creativity of the improvisation side. So it's a great outlet for teaching as also playing. So I kind of always expose my students to this style of music.
Well, Jason, we're up against the clock, and I want to be sure to give you plenty of time to play us one more number. You're going to play us out on something. Tell us what it is.
So we're going to play I Can't Give You Anything But Love, which is one that Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli recorded. And to me, it kind of encapsulates the spirit of Gypsy Jazz. And so when people come out to the Django by the Sea Festival, they'll get that lively energy, the excitement, and the joy that this song kind of encapsulates.
All right. Well, guys, take it away. That's Jason Anik. He's a jazz violinist who founded the Rhythm Future Quartet, and they'll be performing Columbus Day weekend at the Django by the Sea Gypsy Jazz Festival in Kittery, Maine. And we'll go out today with the Rhythm Future Quartet playing I Can't Give You Anything But Love. And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.